Matthew's Use of the Old Testament, the seventh talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on April 22, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to do something a little bit different this week. Last week you looked at Isaiah chapter 7, in which there is a prediction of a sign made. And that prediction of a sign is of a boy that will be named Emmanuel. And that's referred to by Matthew in the first chapter of Matthew. And I mentioned last week that I would talk about that reference in Matthew to this passage in Isaiah. And I debated during the week whether I would just spend a little time on that or whether I would do something a little bit more expansive, and decided to do something a little bit more expansive. So I've been looking at the use of the Old Testament in the book of Matthew. It's a slow project. I'm only about a third of the way done, but I have started on it, and I found it very interesting. And what I have found is relevant to this topic today. So what we're going to do today is look at a few passages in Matthew and where he uses the Old Testament. And then we're going to look at the Old Testament passages. Most of them are in Isaiah. And see if we can figure out what Matthew is doing with the text from the Old Testament. So we'll be skipping around a bit. Lick your fingers, and we'll make our way through this. Okay. Last week in chapter 7, here's the situation. Ahaz is confronted with a situation in which the nations, the kingdoms of Israel and Aram, are threatening to attack. And apparently they have attacked earlier and have been victorious against Judah. In one occasion, they took away 200,000 people as captives. So Ahaz knows that this is a formidable, that both of these countries are formidable with respect to Judah. And he's afraid that they are going to, that now they're uniting, they will come and they will clearly do in Judah. And I'll just point out that if you're the king of a defeated country, in all likelihood, you die. You either die or you're taken into captivity. So the stakes are fairly high for Ahaz. Ahaz is concerned, and he goes out to inspect the pools in Jerusalem, apparently in anticipation of a siege. He's looking to see if there will be enough water available, and if there are things that can be done to improve their ability to retain water and hold out for a long time in a siege. Isaiah goes out and meets him there, and Isaiah speaks to him with a word from God, and what he tells him is that in less than 65 years, these two kingdoms that he's afraid of will be gone, so don't worry. If you're Ahaz, you're still worried because 65 years is a long time. And what will happen in the interim? So Ahaz does seem to be still worried. And by the way, as later events unfold, it becomes clear that even at this point in time, Ahaz has a plan. And his plan is that he will look to Assyria for help against Israel and Aram. Assyria is the growing power in the world at that time. It is moving west, and it is because Assyria is moving west that Aram and Israel have formed an alliance. And their plan is to form an alliance of all the kingdoms in the area, including Judah. And that's why they are fighting against Judah. They want Judah to join in this alliance against Assyria. But Ahaz's plan is he will ask Assyria for help against Israel and Aram. And that's what ultimately ends up happening. But Isaiah says to him, don't worry. God will take care of things. In 65 years, Aram and Israel will be gone. Then Isaiah comes back with another offer. He says, from God, speaking for God, ask for a sign, any sign. Ahaz says, no, I don't test God. And I think my best guess here is that he's afraid that God is going to play gotcha, that God's going to entice him into asking for a test and then punish him for doing so. But I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what his motivation is. In any case, Ahaz says, no signs. I don't do signs. I don't do tests. And Isaiah comes back and says, well, then God is offering a sign. And the sign is going to be that a son will be born to a young woman. And by the time that son grows up to know good from evil, those two kingdoms will be forsaken. And also, as that child reaches maturity, that he will be eating honey and curds, indicating that within this time period, and most people think that that means when he reaches puberty, within the next 13 years or so, the country is going to be depopulated significantly such that people will be eating curds and honey. That is, there's a limited amount of honey. In order to have a good shot of being able to eat some, they're going to have to be less people in the area. And curds are what they do with excess milk. You convert the excess milk into curds and eat it in that form. So that indicates a big decrease in the population is coming before that child is 13. And God will forsake the two countries. So that's what's happening. As best I understand it, that's what's happening in Isaiah. So there's no real, there's not really a miracle that's in view here. It's just a sign. And the sign is there's going to be a young male in our midst who will be named Emmanuel, which means God is with us, and he will be a reminder of the promises of God. And by the time he's 13 years old, Aram and Israel will be gone. So that's what's being communicated to Ahaz. Now, Isaiah was writing in the 8th century. In the 3rd century, the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew into Greek. And when this passage was translated from Hebrew into Greek, the translator or translators made some interesting choices with respect to how to translate the Hebrew. The Hebrew word for the young woman is Alma, which means a young woman, usually is of the age of sexual maturity, but generally speaking, one that's not married. It does not specifically mean virgin. There's another word in Hebrew for virgin. That other word for virgin is not used here. But to say that a young woman will conceive would probably be a little bit interesting to the reader. This was translated into Greek using the word parthenos. Parthenos in classical Greek means a young woman. It does not mean virgin necessarily. But as time went on in Greek usage, as we get into the Hellenistic period, it usually has the connotation of virgin. So the Greek word has a stronger connotation of virginity than does the Hebrew word. And that was the word that was used to translate the Hebrew word into Greek. There are, by the way, a couple of other changes, that interesting choices that the translator of the Septuagint made. One is that in the Hebrew, the most likely way to take the verb tense is she has conceived, but in the Greek, it's translated into she will conceive. The other change that's made is in the Hebrew, it says she will call his name, but in the Greek, it is you will call his name. I don't know how to account for those two. It's possible that the Septuagint at this point was translating a different Hebrew text than the one that we have, but I don't know. In any case, the choice of how to translate the word young woman is interesting, and it's understandable, but it is an interesting choice. Both the Hebrew Old Testament text and the Septuagint text could be understood in a way that there's nothing miraculous that's in view whatsoever. Okay, what does Matthew do with this? Let's look at Matthew chapter 1, verses 18 through 25. Verse 18. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, he was found to be with child by the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man, and not wanting to disgrace her, desired to put her away secretly. But when he had considered this, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, for that which has been conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. And she will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for it is he who will save his people from their sins. Now all this took place, that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, Behold, the virgin shall be with child, and shall bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which translated means God with us. And Joseph arose from his sleep, and did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, and took her as his wife, and kept her a virgin until she gave birth to a son, and he called his name Jesus. Obviously, the situation that Matthew is describing is significantly different from the one that's described in Isaiah in chapter 7. Completely different set of circumstances, generally speaking. But there are a couple of things that must have struck Matthew and must be the reason that he included this passage in his account. One is that Jesus was born to a virgin. That has to be very striking. In Isaiah, if I'm understanding it correctly, the boy was not born to a woman who was virgin when she conceived, when she gave birth. But in the Septuagint, it uses a term that has that strong connotation, and Matthew's picking up on that. Here's a case where a young boy was born to a genuine virgin, someone who's a virgin when the child is born. The second thing is the name of the boy, and it says in Isaiah, will be God is with us. And he was just kind of a sign of God being with the nation of Israel. There's a sense in which Jesus was more fully God with us. Jesus was uniquely God, was uniquely representative of God. And so it was more fully true here. So what I would argue is Matthew is not looking at this as though Isaiah predicted the birth of Jesus, but he sees some parallels. And he uses that to his advantage in telling the story of Jesus. And exactly how he uses that to his advantage is something that we need to talk about. But he's seeing some parallels, and therefore he uses it, even though it's not predictive of Jesus' birth. Okay, so the thing that's tricky here is, what does he mean by fulfilled? Matthew, there are about 15 times that Matthew talks about Old Testament passages being fulfilled. And it'll be helpful for us to look at a couple other passages where he sees the Old Testament being fulfilled. Let's look at Matthew 2, 16 through 18. Just turn the page. It says, "Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged." Oh, just a minute. Let me go back and set the scene. The Magi, the wise men from the east, they've seen a star, something in the skies that indicates the birth of a king in Israel. And so they make the trek to Israel to find this king, because this is a big event. The stars are telling them this is a big event. They make that trip, but they don't know exactly where this king is located. And so they go to the king of Israel, he should know, Herod, and they ask him. And he doesn't know where this king is been born, but Herod would like to know where this king has been born, because Herod thought he was king. And so Herod says, "Well, I don't know where he is, but when you find him, come back and tell me where he is." So the Magi go and they find Jesus in Bethlehem. But afterwards, instead of going back to Herod and telling him where Jesus is located, they just go back home. So that's where we pick up the action in 16. "Then when Herod saw that he had been tricked by the Magi, he became very enraged and sent and slew all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its environs, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the Magi. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, 'A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to be comforted, because they were no more.' But when Herod was dead, behold," and I'll skip the rest of that. Okay, now we need to go back and look at the verse in Jeremiah and see what's going on there to see why Matthew would have included this in his account. And that account is in Jeremiah 31, 15 through 17. Jeremiah 31, 15 through 17. "Thus says the Lord, 'A voice is heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel is weeping for her children. She refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Thus says the Lord, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, and your work shall be rewarded, declares the Lord, and they shall return from the land of the enemy. And there is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children shall return to their own territory.'" Okay, in Jeremiah, what's happening is Jeremiah is, and I have not studied Jeremiah carefully, so I'm not positive that this is all predictive of the future, but I think it is. What Jeremiah is predicting is that the people of Judah will be conquered by the Babylonians, and that the Babylonians are going to round up a significant number of them and take them away into exile. But, and that's what the women are lamenting, that's what Rachel is lamenting, is her children being taken away. Now, Rachel's not living at this time. Rachel lived a long time earlier. But Rachel, I think, here is being taken as a kind of a symbol of all of the mothers of Israel. Rachel, as you will recall, was the wife of Jacob. She was the fourth of the mothers of the children of Jacob. She was the last to give birth. She was the one who most wanted to have children. Finally, she had children. One of her children was Benjamin, the most beloved, and Ramah is located in the territory of Benjamin. So presumably that's that connection then that's being made by Jeremiah in making this prophecy, that Rachel stands for the mother who dearly wanted her children. And now, at this point in time, they are being taken away into exile by the Babylonians. So that is the weeping that is happening, as described in Jeremiah. But notice that it doesn't stop at the weeping. It does say that she refuses to be comforted for her children because they are no more. Well, there's a sense in which they weren't no more, but there's another sense in which they were still. They still existed. They were taken away into exile. It goes on to say, "Restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears, for your work shall be rewarded, declares the Lord, and they shall return from the land of the enemy. And there is hope for your future, declares the Lord, and your children shall return to their own territory." So there's a sense in which this is a temporary bereavement. They're coming back. So in Jeremiah, it goes on with a very comforting message. Yes, there's weeping now, but they will come back. So what's Matthew doing? This is not predictive. It's predictive, but it's predictive of something with short-term realization. That Jeremiah is predicting that those children from Judah will be taken away, but it also predicts that they will be brought back. In Matthew, it's talking about something different. Here, children have been rounded up, and by the way, I had not, in looking into this, they estimate that given the population of Bethlehem at the time of Jesus, it would have been about 20 or 30 young males under the age of 2. So it's about 20 or 30 young boys that would have been rounded up and killed. Those children that are being killed are going to be the cause of grief and crying for the women, the mothers there. That makes a lot of sense. But those children can't come back. Those children will die. So what is Matthew doing? Again, I think what Matthew has done is picked on an event that occurred in the Old Testament that bears some similarities to the event in Matthew, and he's capitalizing on those similarities to show that there is significance to what's happening in the life of Jesus, in the account that he's telling of Jesus. In Jeremiah, they are weeping for children that are being taken away into exile, but not being killed. In Matthew, they're weeping for children that are being killed. In Jeremiah, they're being comforted with the words that they're coming back. In Matthew, he doesn't include that comfort. But I think that that's what he has in mind, is that there is a comfort built into this. And that comfort is that there is one in their midst that is going to take care of their eternal destiny, that will bring them back eternally from a spiritual exile. And Jeremiah has seen those parallels and has decided to use that passage to reinforce the message that he's presenting in the Gospel of Matthew. I think what's happening here is he's using the word fulfillment in the sense of there are things that are related in the Old Testament that embody the values and purposes of God in the story. You can see in the story the values and the purposes of God. And what Matthew is seeing is that there are situations in the life of Jesus where those same values and purposes can be seen and actually in a more profound way. So it's being fulfilled in the sense that it's being filled out. It's being clarified, explicated. Let's look at another use of the word fulfill in Matthew. This is in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5 of Matthew, after he gives the Beatitudes. Starting in verse 10 then, he is explaining in greater detail the Beatitudes. And I think that in 10 through 20, that is all commentary on the last of the Beatitudes. The last of the Beatitudes is in verse 10. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Then the explication. And in that explication, verses 17 through 20, what he emphasizes there is with respect to the very charge that will be most commonly leveled against his followers by their fellow Jews, and that is that they don't value the law of Moses. They don't take it seriously. Jesus was accused of that. Paul was accused of that. Stephen was accused of that. So here's what Jesus has to say. Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets. I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then annuls one of the least of these commandments and so teaches others shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. So his point is, far from not taking the law of Moses seriously, Jesus is saying, I take it very seriously. I didn't come to take anything away from the law. I didn't come to destroy it, annul it. I didn't come to dismantle it. But I came to fulfill it. What does he mean by fulfill? I'm not exactly sure, but it has to be something close to the opposite of destroying, annul, dismantling. So I think fulfill here is being used in a similar way to the use in the previous two passages, insofar as he's saying, I came to fill it out. I came to clarify, explain, validate, rather than to destroy. Okay, so I think that it's important to keep in mind that understanding of fulfill as you're reading through the uses of the Old Testament in Matthew. Let's look at one other interesting verse in Matthew where he uses the term fulfill. Matthew 2:23. It says, I'll start at the beginning of the sentence in 22. And being warned by God in a dream, he departed for the regions of Galilee and came and resided in a city called Nazareth, that what was spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He shall be called a Nazarene. Okay. So here's another use of the word fulfill. People have looked in vain for such a prophecy in the Old Testament. Nazareth apparently did not exist in Old Testament times. It's possible that Nazareth came into existence at the end of the Old Testament times, but it would have been at the very end. And Nazareth does not show up in the Old Testament. Furthermore, the name Nazareth does not show up in any writings prior to the Christian era, at least none that people have found. So what could possibly be going on when he says, when Matthew says that what was spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled, he shall be called a Nazarene. There is a commentary by R.T. France, which I found very helpful. And he points out a few things that are significant with respect to this passage. He offers an interpretation that I find compelling. The first is, notice that it doesn't, typically every place else we've looked, it says the prophet, and oftentimes it will name the prophet, but in Matthew he doesn't always name the prophet. But in this instance, it's used in plural, the prophets. The other thing that's interesting is that what was spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. And literally, it says in the Greek, it's got hati, that. Whereas in the other sentences where it's introducing a prophecy, it says through the prophets might have been fulfilled when the prophet said. And then it will quote the prophet. So he's using slightly different wording in two different spots in this introduction to the prophecy. In both instances, indicating first that it's more than one prophet that he's drawing this from, and the second suggesting that it's not a direct quote, but it's rather the essence of the prophecy. R.T. France's suggestion is that Nazareth was kind of the quintessential nowhere. It's kind of like, being from Lodi, California? Would that be a good equivalent? That it's kind of a nowhere. It's even smaller than Bethlehem. They think that the population of Nazareth at the time of Jesus couldn't have been more than 450 people. And we know that when Philip was told of Jesus, his response was, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" So Nazareth seems to be kind of a proverbial place of nothingness. There's nothing of value that comes from Nazareth. It's interesting that it's kind of a relatively new town. Maybe the best equivalent would be something like Levitt Town or something like that. I don't know. So what would Matthew be doing with this prophecy then? What's he thinking? R.T. France's suggestion is that Matthew has picked up on the fact that in more than one of the Old Testament prophets, there are prophecies that indicate that the Messiah will be nondescript, come from humble surroundings, and will therefore be dismissed by his countrymen as being one of a person of any significance. There are passages to that effect in the Psalms and in Zechariah, but there's one in Isaiah, and since we're studying Isaiah, I thought I'd use that one. Isaiah 53:1-3. It says here, "Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face. He was despised, and we did not esteem him." And then I could go on, but that you get the idea. So R.T. France is suggesting that Matthew is picking up on that, the theme that you see here and elsewhere in the prophets, that the Messiah would come from a humble background. I will quote from France's commentary. He says, "On this view, then, the words, 'He shall be called a Nazarene,' represent the prophetic expectation that the Messiah would appear from nowhere and would, as a result, meet with incomprehension and rejection. Of course, the prophets could not speak specifically of Nazareth, which did not even exist when they wrote. But the connotations of the derogatory term Nazarene, as applied in the first century to the messianic pretender Jesus, captured just what some of the prophets had predicted, a Messiah who came from the wrong place, who did not conform to the expectations of the Jewish tradition, and who, as a result, would not be accepted by his people. Even the embarrassment of an origin in Nazareth is thus turned to advantage as part of the scriptural model which Matthew has worked so hard to construct in his introductory section of his account of the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, we'll look at one more passage. This, and I'm using this one primarily because we have already seen it in Isaiah. Matthew uses it in chapter 13, verses 14 through 15. But before we look at Matthew, let's look at, I'll remind you what happened in chapter 6 of Isaiah. In chapter 6, Isaiah had a vision. It's a vision of God seated on his throne in the temple with his robes filling the temple. And behind God in this vision were the seraphim. And the seraphim are speaking of the holiness of God. They are chanting or singing, "Holy, holy, holy." Isaiah is present there and is overwhelmed by a sense of uncleanness and his sinfulness. And so he says, "Woe is me. I'm a man of unclean lips." And I think what that means is Isaiah, because of his spiritual condition, is incapable of saying the things that the seraphim are saying. He says, "I am a man of unclean lips, and I come from a people of unclean lips." And a seraph then takes a coal, presumably from the altar of incense, and flies to Isaiah and presses that coal against Isaiah's lips and then declares his sins forgiven. So there's a purification that those coals are indicating. Then God says, "Who will I send?" And Isaiah seems to understand that what it means is, who will God send to his people with unclean lips? And Isaiah volunteers, "Here I am, send me." And so God then delivers the message to Isaiah that he wants Isaiah then to take to the people of Judah. And that's what we'll read in Isaiah chapter 6, verses starting with verse 9. And he said, "Go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed." Then I said, "Lord, how long?" And he answered, and I won't go on because we talked about that last week. But he goes on, and God says that there will be after, and finally, there will be a holy seed that will remain and will restore Israel. It is those first two verses, though, that Matthew quotes in chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. Let me read, starting with verse 10. And the disciples came and said to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" And he answered and said to them, "To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him shall more be given, and he shall have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing they do not see, and while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. And in their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, 'You will keep on hearing, but will not understand. And you will not keep, and you will keep seeing, keep on seeing, but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull, and with their ears they scarcely hear. And they have closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes, because they see, and your ears, because they hear. For truly I say to you that many prophets and righteous men desired to see what you see and did not see it, and to hear what you hear and did not hear it. So Jesus is referring to this passage in Isaiah to explain why he's using parables. In Isaiah, what God was saying to Isaiah was, there is going to be a hard-heartedness that's going to come over the people of Judah such that they are not responsive to my message. And like I said last week, God brought that about, and exactly why he brought that about is not clear, but I think at least part of that is that's the story that God wanted to tell that highlights his patience, his mercy, and forgiveness. And in order for him to highlight that, he had to have an object towards which he could show an abundance of mercy, patience, and forgiveness. But in any case, that is the spiritual state that the people of Judah are going to be immersed in. That will be their spiritual state. Jesus, then, in speaking in parables, seems to be doing that for the same purpose that God had in putting them in this condition of hard-heartedness. That is to say that God wants objects with respect to which he can show his abundance of mercy. And he speaks in parables because parables are what Kierkegaard, I think, would call an indirect form of communication. He isn't speaking straightforwardly. He's using images to convey his meaning. So it's a little less accessible. It's a little less clear what those images represent. And the parables are accessible to one who can make the associations. And one who can make the right associations is one that I would describe as one who is a sympathetic listener. That is, someone who desperately wants to know what is being communicated and is willing to put in the effort to figure that out. So Jesus has chosen a form of communication that requires on the part of the listener a kind of sympathy, a benefit of the doubt, such that parables are kind of a screening process, that those who don't have that prerequisite will have difficulty understanding what's being communicated. But one who has that prerequisite, and it's a spiritual prerequisite, will be able to see what is being communicated. So in other words, the state that God had put the people of Judah in at the time of Isaiah continues to be the condition, and Jesus is interacting with them, assuming that that is the condition, on the basis that that is the condition. And in that sense, it's a fulfillment of what Isaiah had said, that the people of Judah are still in that condition that was predicted. Okay. So what does fulfill mean, the way that Matthew is using it? There are times in Matthew where he uses the term fulfill with respect to a specific prediction from the Old Testament that becomes a part of reality. It's played out in reality. That he does use the word fulfill in that sense. But at least as often, he uses it in another sense, and that is in indicating that the values and purposes of God that are shown in specific instances in the Old Testament are coming to play and emerging in actions in the life of Jesus that show up those purposes and values more profoundly or more clearly. Let me see if I can describe what I mean by that. And the image that I, the, the, yeah, the paradigm that I use for this is thinking about a well-crafted novel or a well-crafted film. In a well-crafted novel, every detail is chosen by the author to highlight his purposes, whatever those purposes are. They all contribute to it, and an attentive reader can pick up on the associations that are being made. I am not much of a film watcher, but I watched a film, and I can't remember what the film was, but it was on a DVD, and it had the director's comments at the end of it. And all I remember from the director's comments was that he was pointing out that every time this one character was present on in the screen, that there was some object that was that would stand out, some object someplace in the screen that would stand out that had the that was a bright red color. And then what? Sixth Sense. There it is. Okay. So the author was counting on building up that connection in order to relate what he wanted to relate. And Toby can tell us what the theme is those red things are pointing to. But I thought that was interesting because having seen the film, I hadn't noticed that whatsoever. But once he pointed it out, then it was an interesting connection, and I could see how that was playing into what he was doing. Similarly then, God as the author of history, I think, has built into the Old Testament accounts foreshadowings of things that were going to happen later that would happen in a way where those, the values and the purposes of God would become even more apparent. And that Matthew is picking up on those foreshadowings. And when he says it fulfilled that foreshadowing, what he's saying is, remember that passage back there? There was a certain kind of thing going on. There were certain values that were being exhibited there. There were certain purposes of God that you could see there. Well, now in the New Testament, those same values and purposes are even more clear. Therefore, it has been fulfilled. It's been filled out. It's clearer. If that's the case, then, if we come back to the passage we were talking about last week in chapter 7 of Isaiah, it puts Jesus in a very interesting light. Likening Jesus to the little boy Emmanuel helps me at least to picture what role Jesus was playing as he walked around on earth in Israel. Because if you will recall, the little boy was just this little clock. This little clock whose name was God is with us. And people could look at him and be reminded, oh yes, God is with us, and in a finite period of time, our dreaded enemies will be gone. But there's nothing miraculous about that. That's only good to people of faith. That's of no reassurance to someone who has no faith. Jesus plays a similar role. He was expected by the Jews to come in a very dramatic form, come as the obvious ruler who is going to make things right and do things that were impressive. But Jesus comes and preaches. He does perform some miracles, and those are significant, but far fewer miracles than he could have performed. For the most part, he's just going around teaching. So he's more of a reminder than he is a dramatic display of God's power and control of things. He is a reminder for those of faith. He's a reminder for those who are sympathetic and willing to give God the benefit of the doubt. Okay, there are a couple of things that I would like to point out that I find very interesting about about this understanding of Matthew's use of the Old Testament. If we think back to the passage where Matthew quotes Jeremiah saying, Rachel will be weeping for her children. If I'm understanding that passage correctly, the reason that that's in there is to be of comfort that although there is weeping today, as in what Jeremiah said, there is a huge comfort yet to come. And my guess is that with what Matthew is doing is making the similar association. There may be weeping today, and that weeping is very real. That's what happened is very painful. But there is huge comfort, even better comfort coming. If that's what he's doing, then Matthew is expecting the reader to know a lot about the context of that passage in Jeremiah. He's expecting the reader to be able to make those connections. The reader's thinking, okay, I remember that passage, I remember what it said after that, and then make those connections. And I'm becoming more and more suspicious that Matthew is expecting his readers to have that kind of knowledge of the Old Testament as they read the gospel that he wrote. He's expecting you to make associations and go back and think about the Old Testament passage and the significance of that, what's going on there, and make the proper connections. And by quoting from the Old Testament, I suspect, by and large, what he's doing is doing the same thing that we would do by saying Isaiah chapter 7, verses 7 through 10. It's his way of referencing a text. They didn't have chapter and verse designations at that time, so he's apparently designating it by just quoting a few lines from it. But we ought not think that that's all that he has in mind is those few lines. He's just referring you to a passage and expecting you to be able to figure out what were the points in that passage and how do they relate to what to the topic at hand here. If that's true, that has huge implications for us. That is to say, we need to be much more thoroughly informed and educated with respect to what the Old Testament has to say. In detail, understand what the authors of the Old Testament are saying, but also, I think Matthew is relying on a bigger picture of what's going on. That it's that big picture of what God is doing in history that is interesting to Matthew and he's making the connections to. So when Matthew is making his case, part of his argument, his case is not so much, look at all these detailed things that were predicted in the Old Testament and now we see them all coming true. There is some of that. But much of his argument is rather, look at the Old Testament and see what God is doing in history. See what kinds of, what trajectory history has. And now look at the life of Jesus. Isn't that entirely true with that trajectory that you see in the Old Testament? So part of his argument is a neatness and coherency argument. Look how neat and coherent the whole picture becomes when we look at the life of Jesus and what he did. I will point out that if I'm understanding what fulfillment is in this second sense, rightly, that it isn't predictive. In fact, it can only be well identified after the fact. Matthew couldn't have predicted the events in the life of Jesus based on those passages he's referring to. But after it happens, then he says, oh my goodness, look here, there's a connection. So it's only in retrospect then that this kind of fulfillment can be observed, can be identified. The other thing that's interesting about this is if Matthew is just using a line or two to help the reader to make an association between what he's talking about and a passage in the Old Testament, it doesn't have to be quoted exactly. And that's always bothered me. I've always thought, in the past, I thought, well, if you want to know what the Old Testament says, what the correct reading of the Old Testament is, look at the New Testament and see how they quote it. But if I'm right in that he's just using it to identify a passage, he doesn't have to use the exact words. I've been known to refer to passages where I couldn't remember them correctly, so I used approximate wording. But not only that, but he can tweak the wording a little bit to help make the association he wants to make. It works well for him to use the Septuagint translation to make the association between the young woman in Isaiah and the Virgin Mary. Why not use it? That doesn't mean that Parthenos was exactly what Isaiah had in mind, but it does help make the connection that God ultimately had in mind. Okay. One other thing that I wanted to, that I am struck by more and more, it's come out in some things that I've said over the last few weeks, but every place I turn, I'm more and more impressed by it. God could have so orchestrated things that we as human beings were overpowered by his signs of his greatness, his righteousness, his power, his divinity. He could have done that. But the Old Testament, well, the Bible as a whole, is surprisingly not that kind of thing. The New Testament in Matthew's presentation is surprisingly not that kind of thing. Jesus, when he came, was surprisingly not that kind of thing. Why would God have done it this way? And I've used this illustration before. If you've heard me use it before, forgive me. But think of a situation where you have been accused of a heinous crime. And people who know you are split with respect to whether they think you committed it or not. Some think you did, some think you didn't. And you are absolutely innocent. And you're listening to these responses that people out there have with respect to you, people who know you, people who even know you well. Now, someone comes along and gives you DNA evidence that proves without any doubt that you did not do it. What are you going to do with that piece of evidence? Do you show it to everyone? Or do you wait? By waiting, something that you're going to find out is who out there basically trusts you? Who out there is willing to give you the benefit of the doubt? If you show them the evidence, you won't find that out anymore. You will find out nothing more with respect to that question. But if you withhold that evidence, you might find out a lot with respect to that question. God chose to withhold the evidence. That basically what he's doing is sitting and watching, who gives me the benefit of the doubt? Who basically trusts me? As opposed to coming in displays of power such that no one could disagree, but you don't know what those people really think with respect to God. And that seems to be what God has done. Okay, questions, comments?
David, that's a very good explanation about what I think is happening in Matthew. And it strikes me that that's often what we use in conversation. I remember particularly when I was younger, a child, adults talking about, oh, that's as bad as such and such, or mm-hmm. do you remember such and such and mm-hmm. such and such? Mm-hmm. And being young, I was totally ignorant. And so I think he's using like a common motive of people to like relate to something that you do know, to something in the past. And it makes me wonder, like with Matthew, how much is known about the audience that he was writing to? Because it sounds like they at least would have had some knowledge of the Old Testament, either through the Hebraic or the Septuagint. Mm-hmm.
I think undoubtedly they would have known the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And how well they knew it, I don't know for sure. It is interesting that there's a lot of study. Since the 90s, there's been an enormous amount of study that has gone into trying to reconstruct what Israelite society was like in what's called the Second Temple period. And usually that's with reference to the 100 years before Jesus and then after Jesus until the temple was destroyed. We don't know a lot because there hasn't been many sources with respect to that, mm-hmm. but there are more sources now. We have the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, and the other thing that's happening that's really interesting is there are Jews who are very familiar with Jewish literature who are seeing the New Testament texts as evidence of what things were like in the Second Temple period. So that's been very profitable. But having said that, I don't think that, at least I don't know enough from having looked at what they are saying to answer that question, would people have known the Old Testament text intimately? Would your average person have known that? But some would have, definitely some would have. I met a rabbi a few months ago. His father was a rabbi. His father was from Poland and had memorized the entire Old Testament in Hebrew and in Polish. Then he moved to the United States and memorized it all in English. So the entire Old Testament in three different languages. I'd go crazy. I mean, I don't know where I'd stuff it. That's just amazing. But, and that's not unique. Since then, I've heard of a number of, especially rabbis, who have memorized the entire Old Testament. Well, if you've memorized the entire Old Testament, you should be able to make some of those connections with just a phrase. You should be able to think, I know where that is. And they don't even have an iPhone or an app or whatever.
You know, that's an extremely old practice to do those types of things. Mm-hmm. But next thing I want to ask is, how much knowledge is there of the translators from Hebrew into Greek?
The Septuagint?
Yes. Very little, or?
Well, yes, very little.
Okay.
There's the story, I think it's in Josephus, where he says that there were 70 scholars, Jewish scholars, who were put together. Each one sat down and translated the entire Old Testament. So they had 70 copies then when they were all done. They brought those all together and compared them, and they were all exactly the same. And that becomes the Septuagint. Septuagint means the 70, so that's where that comes from. But largely thought to be an apocryphal story. And so who actually translated it and what they were working from and all that sort of thing, to my knowledge, that's not known to us.
Okay, I just thought it would be interesting if we knew they were priests or scholars or whatever.
It would be
interesting. I was thinking a priest's perspective would probably be different than someone who's considered a scholar. So
could be, yeah.
David, assuming that his readers had a familiarity with the Old Testament, why does Matthew say, and the word was translated, you know, he says Emmanuel, and then being translated, mm-hmm. God is with us. Mm-hmm. Is he assuming that his readers don't have that very good handle in the Greek then, on the Septuagint? Like he's helping his readers by translating the word?
He's helping them by translating it, that's right. Yeah. So he's assuming that Hebrew is not known to them, or not, they aren't fully conversant in Hebrew. So I don't know. It may be that he has a mixed audience in mind, but he at least envisions some who only know Greek, who don't know Hebrew, which is not inconceivable in the diaspora. When the Jews were spread out through the Roman Empire, a number of them went into other parts of the Mediterranean area, and they lost their ability to speak Aramaic and lost their ability to understand Hebrew, many of them. So their knowledge of the Old Testament was through the Septuagint.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you. This is really incredible. Lots of, I can listen to this one on tape again. I'm thinking about the...
I hope it's clearer on tape.
Okay. I'm thinking about some of the new believers, Gentiles in particular, who I'm assuming probably wouldn't have had much history or knowledge of the Old Testament or the stories. First of all, is that a fair assumption to make?
Well, I actually think not.
Okay.
That when we're talking about the first believers after the time of Jesus, initially they're Jews. The first believers are Jews. The next group that seems to respond positively to the gospel are what are called the God-fearers. And those are Gentiles who started attending synagogues and were absorbing the teaching that they got there. So that group would still have been, and some of them seem to have been very familiar with the Old Testament. So it's the third generation and fourth generation, then now we're starting to get out to Gentiles who don't have that background. That does happen. Clearly that happens.
Okay, so with that section of population in mind, do you know if Paul or the other disciples or other early leaders, if they encouraged that generation of people to learn the stories or learn, like, basically how God has worked in history from before? Before then, I wonder. Do you know how they dealt with that?
Well, I wish that Paul's teachings at Corinth and Ephesus had been taped and put online, so that we could hear those, because that would be phenomenal. And I would love to know what he was telling them, but. I think even from Paul's writings, clearly, Paul is interacting with some people who are not as well-versed in the Old Testament as I think Matthew has in mind and some of the other apostles have in mind. But having said that, he still makes some arguments that require a pretty good knowledge of the Old Testament. So presumably, he's providing them with that kind of background. That's part of what he's doing, I think, is helping them to understand that bigger flow of things so that they can understand how the gospel fits into it. Hebrews clearly assumes a really good knowledge of the Old Testament. And if that was written by Paul, then that's part of what Paul is doing.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.